Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab. Adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
As the financial crisis eases, tensions will mount between the U.S. and China. That's the prediction from the Eurasia Group, which specializes in helping business people understand the political climate in countries where they do business. U.S.-China relations are listed as the top political risk for business in the new year, according to Eurasia Group's annual report. Ironically, they also see the failure of the Copenhagen Climate Change Conference as a risk to carbon-producing companies, and they see Japan devolving from what they call a one-party state to a zero-party state. But the good news for our area, Eurasia says the demise of New York as a financial capital has been greatly exaggerated. Eurasia Group President Ian Bremmer joins me now, along with Art Kleiner, editor-in-chief of Booz & Company's Strategy and Business magazine. Ian, Art, welcome back to WNYC.
Great to be with you, Brian.
Thank you, Brian.
So China's the number one risk at the top of your political hit parade, and we'll get to it. But let me start with climate change, which I found really interesting in your report. You listed it as the number six risk. And one might think that carbon-producing companies would be cheering the failure of the Copenhagen Climate Summit last month, but you actually see that as a risk, or at least a big pain, for the greenhouse gas-producing sector. Why is that?
I think that's right, because it's increasingly unlikely we're going to have an agreement this year as well, a big treaty coming together by the end of the year at Mexico City. But that doesn't mean that countries aren't going to do anything. Europe has already taken on some fairly significant mandatory for their own countries reductions in carbon emissions. And what you'll see is a proliferation of what we'll consider nationally appropriate measures. And your ability to actually comply to all of these different forms of standards, right? It's very inefficient. It's costly to understand. The same sort of problems that we've seen companies having in the United States dealing with all sorts of different state regulations,
right,
we're going to now have at a global level.
So would you predict an effect like when California or New York regulates something, it's one state out of 50, but the market is so large it winds up becoming a national standard because companies don't want to produce multiple versions of their products. So are there certain countries likely to become the toughest on carbon emissions, and then companies will find themselves conforming to that? Art?
Well, I think clearly Europe will be tougher in the short run than America. I think the big question here is risk to whom? In other words, is there a big risk if nothing is done about carbon in general? And if you think there is a big risk, then we rely on companies to do that. If companies perceive that they're not going to have any advantage because there's no barriers to entry, for, you know, that anybody can kind of come along in a less compliant way and undercut you with prices, if they perceive that there's no advantage for them in cutting their carbon, then you're going to have a much more difficult time. And it won't really matter which are the places that don't have it.
Ian, how would that play out in the United States? Because your report says the cap and trade bill will probably have a tougher time in Congress now because of the problems at Copenhagen.
I think it's very difficult to imagine that cap and trade this year actually gets passed, despite the fact that there's been a lot of talk for the Obama administration to make it happen. In part, that's because in the absence of a Copenhagen treaty, they don't have the same amount of stick to actually hit these guys. But also, it's midterm election year. It's difficult to get a lot of policy through. You see the enormous difficulty they've had in just getting health care, which still is to an extent an open question. Financial regulations on the cards. They just don't have the votes to get cap and trade done. And so as a consequence, while Obama was effectively able to deflect blame on the United States at Copenhagen, by the end of 2010, he's going to have a harder time doing that. The U.S. will be seen as more of a scapegoat, there's no question.
And how are businesses actually viewing that? Because certainly the pro-business punditocracy in the media is saying, yay, Copenhagen failed, we won't have these onerous climate change regulations, and cap and trade will have a tough time in the way that you just described. But your report seems to suggest that businesses themselves are a little bit more queasy about that.
Because there's so much uncertainty around it. In other words, I think there's no question that just like you don't like to see, you know, sort of large new taxes, I mean, you know, cap and trade would clearly put in the United States a more difficult environment in place. But you're still going to see lots of carbon emission measures coming out, lots of focus on more spending to make the United States more green, which is going to have an impact on different sectors here. The real issue I see is that just like when you put in new regulatory policy that's radically different around the world on all sorts of issues, this lack of a common standard is going to end up creating lots of inefficiency. It'll make lots of jobs for accountants and lawyers, but ultimately it's going to be inefficient for companies.
Ian Bremmer, president of Eurasia Group, Art Kleiner, editor-in-chief of Strategy and Business Magazine, with us on WNYC as we talk about top political risks for businesses as envisioned by Eurasia's annual report. Our phone number, 212-433-WNYC, if you have anything to add or ask, 212-433-9692, or our webpage always open at WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. And all right, then, let's talk about the U.S. and China. Why are U.S.-China relations the number one political risk in the 2010 report?
Well, you know, last year, geopolitics were basically suspended. Everyone was focusing on their domestic issues and just digging out of what could have been a depression, what certainly was the worst recession we've seen since that time. Geopolitics are coming back now. And in 2010, you have 10% unemployment in the United States. You have 10% economic growth in China. And increasingly, you're going to see those two things directly in conflict. The relationship will become much more politicized. American corporations are having a harder time investing on the ground in China because of competition with state-supported firms. American labor is increasingly concerned about what they consider to be unfair Chinese practices. So you're seeing more push for tariffs and subsidies and protectionism. And the Chinese are reacting. It was very interesting. After this report came out, there was a Chinese press conference for the foreign ministry, and state-owned media asked a question about the report. And there was a 10-minute prepared statement by the Chinese official not disagreeing with the report, saying they took note of it and talking about all the ways that they think the U.S.-China relationship is a challenge.
Take me there. What did they say? Were they kind of wrapping the United States and saying, well, yeah, there are going to be tensions this year and they're your fault?
They were, and they were doing it kind of proactively. I mean, historically, the Chinese government usually, if there's a problem with, let's say, the Dalai Lama coming over on a visit, they wait till afterwards and then they release a statement. In this case, they're saying, we're very concerned about the USA selling arms to Taiwan. We're very concerned about pressure on currency. We're very concerned about an upcoming Dalai Lama visit with Obama. They had a bunch of issues, the sort of a laundry list of things that they were basically putting the U.S. on notice. There's no question that the Chinese feel that the financial crisis was the fault of the United States, first and foremost. They understand that when the U.S. sneezes, that they caught a cold. They don't like that. And they also understand they have a lot more influence today in the global environment. They're actually starting to use some of it.
So, Art, how does some of that play out as a risk to American businesses in 2010?
I think it comes down to three questions. The first is, how much do we need that 1 billion people to pull the rest of the world out of an economic slump? And not just the people in Beijing and Shanghai and along the coast, but the people in the emerging cities in the what were the hinterlands, but which are now rapidly growing.
Urbanizing
very rapidly. Second is, how much is a Chinese employee worth compared to an American or European employee? And again, we're not just talking about somebody working in a factory, although we are, but we're also talking about somebody who's an engineer or a designer or, you know, increasingly a manager even. When R&D heads are moving back from U.S. companies to Chinese companies, as they're starting to do, what are the, you know, how fungible is this talent, and what does any company, any country's companies have that that China does not? And then the third is, is the Chinese government prepared to act as a kind of mercantile, unified, single force, or is it subject to the same kinds of give and take that other governments are? I think all those questions are unknown.
And as a matter of business strategy, we had a couple of guests earlier in this week who were doing exactly what you predicted would happen, which is calling for more protectionist barriers. And their argument was, we need a manufacturing sector in the economy in the United States. We're not going to have a manufacturing sector if they're paying people $2 a day or whatever it is in China, and so many manufacturing businesses want to go over there. It's too important to the future of the American economy and the American worker not to put some blocks on those goods that undercut Americans in such a way. Do you argue against it?
I think it's a partial answer. The problem is, if we had huge protectionist blocks, that's still no guarantee that American manufacturers would be any smarter or better than they were in the past. I mean, essentially, American companies did not lose jobs to Chinese companies. Poorly run manufacturing companies lost jobs to companies that could make things more cheaply than they could for a variety of reasons. There were lots of other things we could have done to keep American manufacturing jobs here. That doesn't mean that labor costs don't matter, but it's one of a whole bunch of other factors.
Other things like what?
Well, the quality of manufacturing, the ability to deploy technology effectively, the ability to locate plants close to where they are and coordinate between them. A lot of stuff that's called nuts and bolts manufacturing. Economists dismiss it, but it makes a huge difference when you're talking about the viability of a country.
And we have a question from a listener along these lines. Tony in Putnam County, you're on WNYC. Hi, Tony.
How you doing?
What's your question?
My question is, it sounds like to me that the gentlemen are saying that American companies are finding it hard to compete with Chinese state-run or state-owned companies in manufacturing in China. Are they trying to say that there's a possibility that some of these manufacturing jobs will come back to America? Because, you know, it's kind of like the basis for any economy. If you don't make cheap disposable things, you know, what are you really doing? You know what I mean? You need to produce something. So do they think that manufacturing jobs will come back to the United States?
Ian?
I think they probably will, but I don't think it'll be efficient. I mean, look, in Europe, agricultural jobs, there are lots of them. Europe spends over 50% of their budget on an annual basis on subsidizing agriculture. And as a consequence, you have mountains of butter and lakes of milk that end up unconsumed. In the United States, we'll probably end up with mountains of SUVs and lakes of ethanol. You know, there's no question that Detroit has been supported. It doesn't make it necessarily more competitive than the emerging auto industry in China, but those jobs are going to be preserved. Now, is that the best way long-term for the United States to maintain a competitive advantage? Probably not, but I do think that the likely reaction, both from industry-pushed and fostered subsidies and measures against Chinese dumping and the rest, and the impact of American labor, which of course has been more significant, especially with 10% unemployment, is that you will see a rise in measures that will lead to more manufacturing in the U.S. I happen to believe that a lot of that won't be competitive.
Tony, thank you for your call. My guests, Art Kleiner, Editor-in-Chief of Strategy and Business Magazine, Ian Bremmer, president of Eurasia Group. Eurasia Group just out with its annual report of the top political risks around the world to businesses in the United States and elsewhere. By the way, Ian, did you see the report of investor James Chanos, I think is how you say his name, Chanos, who predicted the fall of Enron once upon a time? He's a billionaire hedge fund investor here in New York, now shorting China, selling China short as a potential bubble that may be about to burst rather than keep driving all this growth?
I hope he's a really long-term investor.
In other words, you don't see this anytime soon.
I think that the risks that are coming from the U.S.-China relationship come precisely because the Chinese growth is actually quite robust. You know, a couple of years ago, everyone was saying that if China couldn't grow at 8% a year consistently, that they were going to fall apart. And you saw all these talks about the 80,000 demonstrations a year going on in China. You know, no one's talking about those anymore. There's an enormous amount of political and economic stability in that country right now. I do believe that some of this stuff long-term is unsustainable. 1.3 billion Chinese don't all get cars, right? I mean, they just don't, because the world can't sustain it. But if you ask me, over the next 1, 2, 3 years, are we likely to see very strong, world-beating strong Chinese growth? The answer is overwhelmingly yes.
Tom in the East Village, you're on WNYC. Hi, Tom.
Yes, good afternoon. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm very interested to learn about the availability and the use of political risk insurance when trading with Chinese counterparties.
Insurance.
Well,
yes.
There generally is political risk insurance. The problem with political risk insurance is it's a very opaque market. There's no market mechanism like political futures, for example, to determine what a pricing mechanism should be. It's relatively illiquid. There aren't a lot of providers. And so as a consequence, not a lot of people take out political risk. It's expensive and it can be difficult to get out of your position.
What kinds of things are covered by political risk insurance?
Oh, all sorts of things. I mean, you know, you both from the private sector providers as well as from multinational organizations like OPIC and like JBIC in Japan. You could talk about the risks of sudden nationalizations, for example, and changes in policy that would lead your contract to suddenly be extinct. A sudden coup or a revolution that would mean that your contract, your investment would be suddenly invalidated. All sorts of things where politics can have a dramatic impact on your investment, particularly in relatively unstable environments. Political risk insurance, in principle, can cover you, but you need to find someone that will cover you, and you need to have some discovery mechanism for pricing. And both of those two things are non-trivial operations.
Now, before you both go, we're talking about the 2010 report. You were both here last year at this time for your 2009 risk report, and your number one last year was the risk posed to business by Washington acting aggressively in the financial crisis. And Art, how does that look to you a year later? Because, you know, I could argue that the federal government saved big businesses bacon in 2009 with all the bailouts and everything. Do you not see it that way in hindsight?
No, I do. In the short run, they saved the bacon. In the long run, business and the government have to save each other's bacon. In other words, if we're talking about a viable, economically vibrant country and world, we're talking about a place where business and government run better than they have before. The risk probably is seeing them as opposed to each other, and the fact that they'll continue to see each other as opposed to thinking about how to work more effectively. And that's,
Is it fair to say, because this is certainly the reaction we got when you were here last year and we're talking about that, that the politics you represent are generally those that big businesses in America support? You list as a risk for this year the likelihood that Congress will act on banking reform, something more far-reaching than anything we've seen since the Great Depression, your report says, Ian. What do you foresee in this bill or in these bills that most concerns you?
Well, it's not so much what concerns me. I think this is an analytic exercise. It's not a let's support big business exercise. Political risk is the likelihood that global politics will have an impact on the markets. In other words, you're not going to have the continued baseline that just going out ad infinitum. You have something that happens that creates massive discontinuity. The reason Congress was the number one risk for 2009 was precisely because the impact Congress was going to have to determine who winners and losers were going to be was enormously, almost unprecedentedly outsized in 2009 because of the bailout, because of the stimulus and subsidies, because of things like AIG.
But was that a reflexive fear of government, which turned out to be unfounded in this case?
Oh, I don't think it was a fear of government. It's just an understanding that they suddenly had enormously outsized importance in acting. Risk can be both upside and downside. It just causes massive change. And so what you need to understand are what are the single things, what are the things that are most important that aren't on your landscape that you better understand if you want to position yourself well to do with the emerging world. And there's no question that Congress is much less important in 2010 than it was in 2009. They're not going to move on things like immigration. Healthcare is probably barely going to get through. Don't think cap and trade is going to happen. You've got silly season with elections coming up. The one place that you're probably going to see significant policymaking actually occur out of the United States that will really differentiate how you think about winners and losers is on the financial regulatory side.
But why list that as a political risk? Because didn't the last decade prove that under-regulation of banks let them develop stupid incentives that led to stupid risks that crashed the economy?
I think two things are going to happen as a consequence of this. One is that all of the things that Volcker's been talking about, that the U.S. will end up under-regulation on the big structural issues so that a big bubble can happen again, no question. If financial regulation had happened when the banks were very weak and when Congress had a real appetite for doing something and not politicizing it last year before health care, I think you would have had possibility of really limiting the long-term risk. Instead, you'll see a lot of populist measures, a lot of red meat for constituents. Let's go after some CEO compensation. You'll have lots of things that'll cost you lots of money in the short term, and they won't make the fixes long-term. Sounds like the response to terrorism.
Any disagreement with that, Art? Because Congress believes, Ben Bernanke seems to believe, that reform, including reform in the way CEOs are compensated, is needed specifically to reduce risk.
No question, lack of reform is a huge risk for all of us, for business. If business cares about its future, they care about a viable market, a viable group of customers and investors. No question, lack of reform is a huge risk. The big question is, are we equipped to give the kind of reform that actually makes things better instead of making things worse? And I think the jury's out. I really don't think anybody knows because our system is so ad hoc.
Art Kleiner, editor-in-chief of Strategy and Business Magazine. Ian Bremmer, president of Eurasia Group, their top political risks report. A very interesting read every year. Where can people see it?
They can see it in www.eurasiagroup.net, or they can come see Art and I at the Carnegie Institute for Ethics and International Affairs next Wednesday about lunchtime.
All right. Great. Thanks a lot. Appreciate it. Brian Lehrer and WNYC, and as we look toward the 2010 elections, just the political risks of politics, Democrats and Republicans are both going to be trying to dominate in the net roots, and we'll get a Republican take on that coming up in a minute.